So I'd like to welcome everybody to the 4 o'clock or 3 o'clock or 1 o'clock session or wherever you are in the world. We're going to be talking about modern web development. My name is Sean Wildermuth of Wilder Minds. Let me just make sure that everyone can hear okay. Let me just look at the little voting blocks, and that looks good. If you have any questions, just go ahead and drop them in the Q&A block, and we'll try to address them mostly at the end of the session, maybe during the session in case we have some... So I come from a long line of web development. I've been in and out of the web space for 15, maybe even 20 years now. It's a little hard for me to remember when I first started. And for a long time, especially in the late 90s, this was my temperament with the web. We had a lot of browsers to contend with, even browsers on different operating systems that acted in different ways. All of this became very apparent to me that I didn't want to be doing HTML, JavaScript, classic ASP development for a long time because it just was a painful process. So what we did instead is I wanted to come back to web development in the last maybe 3 or 4 years about after my first forays into Silverlight to really see what the ecosystem was like. And in this case, I found that it's a much calmer and better experience than I had years and years ago. Back then, my development experience was that I was dealing with HTML pages, and on the client side, you know, I would have some initialization code, I'd write some scripts directly on the page, I'd be using get document by ID, there'd often be a big sections in here saying if IE, if Mozilla, if Safari, and then I'd have, you know, inline styling. I'd be using styles here to say how things should be displayed, what color they are, what size the font, and a lot of what it ended up being is that each of my pages here were really ingrained with each other. They were had all three responsibilities. They were about structure, they were about design, and they were about development, all in one space. And so maintaining these over a long time became difficult. As ASP.NET came out, things got a little better, but not a lot better, honestly, because I was able to write pages with a lot more code running on the server than I used to, and in letting the server do a lot of the heavy lifting for me. We can see here using things like the list view and even having standard HTML tags run on the server meant that I could do more interesting things and working with C# instead of a lot of grunge work in the client, but I was still writing some JavaScript on the client, and I was dealing with things like postback and such, and we were still pretty far from developing in HTML as well as whatever my backend content was, and that was the painful part of this entire process, was that even though I was doing web development, I wasn't developing on the web, I wasn't developing for the web, I was developing these backend components that were meant to spit out and eke out something that could be consumed by people in a browser, but I wasn't spending a lot of time actually in the browser. Every time we'd have a problem where it was browser-specific settings, we'd try to do things in the back end to try to solve that, or to try to mitigate that, or in many cases, especially in enterprise development, I found that people I was working with said, well, the solution is just to stick them to a single browser. It simplifies our test scenarios, it simplifies our development scenarios, so make sure everyone in the corporation has to use IE5, IE55, whatever the version and the browser we were going to pin ourselves to. Those days it was mostly IE. So in the last few years, as I've been looking at this, things have changed quite a bit, as most of you know. If you've come from a space where you're doing a lot of web development right now, some of this is going to be review, but hopefully some of this is going to be telling you about some different features about web development. Now, I'm not talking about ASP.NET MVC here. I'm talking about developing for the web on the web. Now, your backend may be MVC. It may be Node.js, and maybe, you know, whatever you need in the back end. You may be doing SharePoint and WordPress. You know, it doesn't matter as much with most of the stuff I'm going to be talking about what the back end is, though the examples are going to be using ASP.NET MVC. One of the problems I found when I came to this new world is, as some of you know, there's this service called Twitter that people are on, and they talk and they post links. It's quite fascinating. You should check it out. Not many people are on it. Not people know what it is. But in listening to them and listening to people that are talking about web development, I found that there was a lot of chatter. There's a lot of words being bantied about, and there's this instinct I have that if you're not using whatever is the edge of what is happening in web development today, that there's sort of a cool kids and not cool kids side of the road. And while what this has done is give us a lot of great tools to work with, it also I found that a lot of web developers felt like they were always playing catch up. You know, I'm using Knockout today, but all I hear is about Backbone or Mustache or whatever the latest MVC framework in JavaScript is. Should I be abandoning all that code? Same with, you know, dealing with design languages and plugins for jQuery and the, you know, SignalR versus Comet, and even, you know, things like Git versus Mercurial. My suggestion here is that there is a lot of chatter and there's a lot of good information being proffered forth. But once you make a decision to start working on a project, pick the tools and pick the pieces that are going to do the job for you. Otherwise, you're going to get caught very much into this world of, you know, ripping out and rewriting over and over again, trying to stay ahead of whatever the curve is. The reality is all these tools are, for the most part, really good at what they're trying to do. And they're all going to have, you know, negatives as they go forward as well as positives. And so kind of pick your poison and move forward is my suggestion here. If you're like me and you came from this older world of web development, the key for me was modernizing my development experience. A big part of that was coming to a cleaner way of developing, whether that's something like Node or MVC, Ruby and Rails, one of those, mature your development experience. In this case, I really suggest ASP.NET MVC allowed me to take all that .NET knowledge I had, all the C# skills I had, and bring them into modern web development. Realize you're going to be doing a lot more client-side development. You're going to be working more in the browser than you ever have, and that's really a good thing. The closer you are to what the users are experiencing, there's less of this rinse and repeat, and hopefully it'll change. In fact, the cycles of updating a website or writing code ends up being a lot shorter for me because I'm doing more and more client-side developing, not using things like postbacks and hoping that the development is there. It also means that the performance of my pages are going to improve because I'm doing more work on the client and spending less time waiting for network requests on one end of the wire or the other to resolve themselves. So as I said, abandoning postback, abandoning viewstake, get used to the idea that you're going to be programming on both sides of the wire and separate your concerns. Keep the markup as markup, which is simply structure. Keep the design and things like CSS and images and less, and we'll talk about some of that stuff. And then keep your code separate as well. You know, when I'm dealing with individual pages, I'm typically dealing with three separate pieces of assets. I'm dealing with a markup page, whether that's CS, HTML, and ASP.NET MVC, or I'm dealing with less in SAS and CSS files for design, and then finally JavaScript and server-side code for the server. One of the things you'll notice in this new world is that you'll do much more of your client-side development in the browser. On a recent project I did that was, you know, fairly decent size, mostly consumer-oriented, had a web story, had a mobile story, about 80% of my web work was done in the browser. About 20% was done on the server. And that's why what you're doing on the server should end up being cleaner so that you can do that client-side development in a pretty straightforward way. I get to do the things I care about more. I get to develop these APIs that my pages are calling instead of developing all this sort of middleware that is trying to spit out HTML in particular ways. And that makes me a happier developer. So in ASP.NET MVC, the way I tend to structure these projects is to separate JavaScript into two different pieces, my code and their code. Now, when we're talking about things like jQuery and jQuery plugins, which we'll dive in a little deeper in a few minutes, this means keeping the JavaScript in a way that I can sort of update it and know what is where, and later when we talk about packaging, it becomes more important where the specific code is. I typically have a view, which is a HTML markup page, a CSS, and a JavaScript file that all marry themselves to a single view. So content is where I typically keep my ECSS, JS is for my JavaScript, and then scripts for their JavaScript. When we look at packaging, this becomes really crucial. It becomes very convenient so that we can package things in the right way, so that the scripts that are someone else's JavaScript, whether they're plugins I'm using or whether it's just something like jQuery, I know that I don't have to package them in the same way that I would package my own JavaScript. I won't have to worry about minification. I won't have to worry about packaging a bunch of scripts into the same file, those sorts of things. So as I stated, typically a view is split up into these three pieces. And let's go out to Visual Studio and show this in a more pragmatic example. So this is Visual Studio 2012. Most of the stuff I'm talking about, if you're using ASP.NET, MVC 2 or 3, and you're using Visual Studio 2010, it's about the same. But on my in my solution, I typically have, as you would expect if you've done any MVC 3, a structure that has my views laid out here, and then controllers that point to those views. So I have a home controller, points to, in this case, a very simple index file. And when I'm dealing with editing this index file, I'm typically dealing with a CSS page in my content for this home for this file, and I typically name these to kind of marry them with the view. So home-index is controller-name of the view, and then I do the same thing for JavaScript, home-index.js for all the code that particular page uses. I'll show you a trick here in how we're sort of packaging this when we get to JavaScript. So as a C# developer and as a managed code guy for a long time, I mean, it may have not been managed, but I was usually going away from scripting most of my career, starting from sort of the C++ world and getting into component development in the COM days and then coming into .NET for the last decade. I've sort of avoided the love of scripting languages in general, but on the web, JavaScript is king. It's something you are going to have to use as your client-side development language. Now, you don't have to learn it. There are other solutions. CoffeeScript, ScriptSharp, both emit JavaScript based on another language. ScriptSharp does it with C#. CoffeeScript has its own language, which is I find it reminiscent of sort of a Perl or a Python sense. But in my opinion, you probably should learn JavaScript, because JavaScript is going to help you understand what's actually going on the page. And instead of trying to map directly the way you do something like C# development to JavaScript, which I think CoffeeScript and both ScriptSharp attempt to do, understanding the power of the language will allow you to do things in a pretty deep way. It also allows you to see how these other libraries you're probably using actually work. So if you run into problems, you can get a sense of what's happening and not have to treat them as a black box. And at the end of the day, you're still going to need to debug JavaScript, even if it's emitted from these other languages. Not everyone agrees with me. A lot of people are very much on the CoffeeScript bandwagon and think it's the way to write your JavaScript. And I can't really dissuade them. Certainly the amount of JavaScript you would need to write is more than the equivalent CoffeeScript, but I think they're wrong. So if we go back to our project, when I'm writing JavaScript, wrong file. I'm typically packaging up my JavaScript into these initializers per page. So this self-executing anonymous function is sort of a way to create something like a namespace or scoping for an application. There's some good documentation on how this works. I'm not going to dive into it too deeply, but essentially it forces this entire function to be executed so that we're passed in jQuery as well as this new object that I'm creating called the app object. And this is going to be sort of the home to everything at the top level, initialization per view, if you will. And then once you're in here, it's just JavaScript. So if I just need to, you know, as I have in this little example, alert a user that, you know, they've come to the particular page. Go back to Firebug. We'll see that this script is actually executing. And the way this executes is on our view, we're actually injecting it onto the page as a script that's being executed. Now, we're going to get rid of this a little later, so I won't go too deeply into how this section script is injected into the layout page. Because of limitations of time, we don't want to get too far into MVC. But the story here is that we want to have this page married to a set of JavaScript. And this may be ones that are wiring up event handlers. This may be running code. This may be waiting for setting up objects like using plugins to change the look of buttons or to, you know, inject a grid into the page, whatever it is. But this is the code that belongs with this particular page. Let's take a quick look at the questions to see if any. So from what we've covered so far, let me answer a couple of these questions pretty quickly. Justin Stoll, I think is how you pronounce his last name, saying, are you saying that you have a CSS file for each view page? Only if it's necessary. So I will often have a CSS per view page, but not necessarily every page. Not every page needs it. But when I have exceptional cases for a CSS that aren't site-wide CSS-specific pieces, I will have a CSS per page. When we talk about packaging later, we'll talk about how we may not actually deliver to the browser a CSS for every page, but in development we would. So at the heart of the JavaScript you're going to be writing likely is jQuery. jQuery many, many people are familiar with, so I don't want to dive too deeply into the discussion of jQuery. But jQuery is for DOM manipulation as well as some other helper functions. It's to enable cross-browser code. So when I want to be able to get and set properties of certain DOM elements or parts of the structure of the elements, being able to do it once that works across all browsers is one of the key reasons for jQuery. So I can write it once, and for the most part, it should work in every browser the same way. That's the key idea here. It has a plugin architecture so that as people want to extend jQuery to do new things, it allows that in a pretty seamless way. We'll look at some plugins in a few minutes. And it's, like I said, cross-browser coding. This has become a fairly game changer in two ways. One is that it's changed the way I think about how JavaScript actually works, because the way that jQuery works is actually very elegant, but unlike most JavaScript I used to write. It also is a game changer because it has made the amount of code I need to write in order to manipulate the DOM much smaller than it used to be. No longer having to walk through the DOM or, you know, child of child of child of child and hope the structure is still the same. It's made that code a lot cleaner. The trick with jQuery really is that there's an alias to the jQuery object, and it's called $. So when you see $ in JavaScript code, it's really just representing this jQuery object that is the root of the API. It allows you to go ahead and search for elements on a page based on the CSS selector syntax. So the experience you have from dealing with CSS, you can apply directly to jQuery. So that if I simply say $div, it's going to return me all the divs in the particular page. So most of the times you're dealing with it, you're actually dealing with the results of a query of the DOM. That's why it's called JDOM, of course, jQuery, of course. So in the project itself here, I have some initialization. And let's talk about how that initialization happens. So I have some boilerplate that runs on every page in this app.js JavaScript. And this piece of JavaScript is loaded on every page. And this actually walks through, and I won't belabor it too much, but walks through and looks for the body tag using jQuery. So returns actually a collection of every body tag, but of course this ends up only being one body tag. And then I'm looking for the attributes of the body tags to have these special attributes that I've added called controller and action to figure out which view I'm on. And then if it exists, I'm attempting to execute this. And so that's why the init home index here ends up being executed on my home index. If we look in Firefox, and let's view the page source. We'll be looking at the debugging stuff in a little bit. We can see that down here on the body tag, I have the attributes that I've added using a MVC called controller and home that I'm using to look. I'm using these to look up what to determine what page I'm on, and I'm just doing this by injecting the name of the controller and the name of the action onto my view so that then in my code here I can tell it to execute a method on my app object called init home index. If this doesn't exist, nothing happens. So the pages that need initialization have a home for that initialization. So let's get back to jQuery briefly. Now that we know that this is being executed, when we start with the dollar sign, that is the jQuery object. And with parentheses, we're going to give it a CSS selector. So if we go ahead and look at our page again, close that one. I'm going to look for something in here to modify. So I'm going to look for, let's view source again so we can see what we're actually, let's not view source. Let's go back to the CHTML. The actual objects I have here have monikers in them. Again, they have classes to say what they are. They have IDs to say what they are. And here's a button that I've called load button. So in my JavaScript, I'm just going to use the CSS syntax, a selector syntax, which is pound name of object to be able to query for that object in the DOM and get at it. And then I'm just going to use a method called on that allows me to wire up an event. I'm going to wire up an event for the click of the on button and then supply a function for what to do when that button is clicked. And so this is sort of the heart of what is jQuery is good at. Querying the DOM to find an element and then doing something with it, whether it's setting an attribute, wiring an event like we're doing here, or we could be doing other things like changing the appearance, even setting the HTML or the text or the value of objects. And here I'll just go ahead and say button is clicked. So now when we call load games, that wire up code was being called on initialization, but this is just wiring it up. This function isn't called until I actually click on the button, which is why when I click the button, we get that alert pop up. And so learning jQuery becomes a heart of the first skill as a client side HTML5 developer that I need to learn. Now, there was a question that was proffered about WinJS and what's its main purpose. I'm not going to talk about WinJS. WinJS is about writing client Windows 8 Metro-style applications using JavaScript. We're talking about web development here, not Windows 8 development. So just in case you'd come for that, just so you know. And I talked about that. Okay, good. Sorry for giving sort of a bum's rush here. We have a lot of topics to cover. I want to make sure we get through them all. The next piece are jQuery plugins, and as I sort of alluded, jQuery plugins allow me to extend jQuery with different abilities. And there are, you know, probably thousands, maybe tens of thousands of these plugins. When I decide I need something like a slider or a special sort of control or a dialogue, I'm going to go look for a plugin first before I decide to dive in and build it. Now, this rich ecosystem has, you know, all these plugins which are great, and many of them, probably a vast majority of them, are free or sort of open source, community oriented plugins. Many of them are hosted on places like GitHub and and other community sites like that. And so having all these controls out there, or all this all these facilities out there, is really good. But has sort of a bad point, so I want to kind of explain the experience of finding a plugin. The problem is that if I want something like a slideshow, I can go ahead and do a query for slideshow, and I get 3.4 million hits for it. So finding one that is sort of the canonical or the best or the one that meets my needs becomes more difficult. In fact, on the first page of that query, two of the first five entries are the 25 best, or in the other case, the 37 best slideshow or gallery plugin solutions. That means there's a ton of these. And for some of the really low-hanging fruit like slideshows, there are a ton of them. And knowing which ones are best, it's just a matter of, reaching out to the community, trying some, investigating to find the ones that work the best. Because just because it looks the best doesn't mean it works the best. And that's an important difference here. Remember that this is just code that other people have written. So some of it may be very bright and shiny to do exactly what you want. And if what the experience of working with a plugin on the demo side, it looks and feels exactly like what you want, you're probably good to go. But as you start to need customizations, as you need for it to do some different things, it becomes more difficult. But if they are open source, that of course means that you could help and aid in their development. You could contribute to the maturation of plugins as well. So it's a little different than some of us are used to if we haven't touched the open source space much. There isn't a benefit, obviously, about price, and that many of these are going to be free. The other problem you have is there is no, at least for now, master naming convention for jQuery plugins. So I had the experience of going out, and I wanted something that would do tagging. If you've ever been on Stack Overflow or Stack Exchange sites where you can tag, I wanted that sort of same experience. Type in a word, press space, and it adds it as sort of a button that I can clear to add tags to a question. I needed that same experience, so I went out and I looked at some examples, and I heard some really good things about this plugin called Tagit, so I looked for it. And I worked with it for a while, and I was like, the people like this? This is awful, until I realized it was Tagit with a dash in it was the one I wanted, not tag it without the dash. And this implies a story that you're going to run into problems knowing which plugins are exactly the ones you're looking for. Sometimes it can be sort of mysterious to find the right plugin that you've heard so much about. It's just a matter of experience until you're going to be super comfortable with this. Because, again, even jQuery plugin Tagit is returning, 1.3 million results because jQuery is so popular. So great that there's lots of code out there. Less than great is in that the same sort of experience you want from a plugin, you could get from, dozens of plugins sometimes. There's a bunch of plugins I like to use, and I tend to use them on many of my sites. jQuery UI is probably the biggest one. And jQuery UI, written by the jQuery folks, is a number of controls and skinning facility for jQuery, mostly pushing towards the sort of form-based entry stuff. They have things like dialogues and ways to add icons to buttons and things like that. Working with the jQuery libraries is pretty important if you're going to do any sort of web development. Fancybox I use quite a bit for showing blow-ups of images. Well, I'll actually use that in a minute to show you an example. Smart Slider is the slider I use on wilderminds.com. I'm a big fan. It's very customizable and performs really well even on mobile devices. Joyride is one I really want people to take a look at. It allows you to do kind of a walkthrough of a website without having to, have the sort of canonical help button. And then Tagit, the one without the dash, is the right one that, after all that investigation, it was worth pointing out to people. So let's see how plugins work. So I've already included a plugin. You may include a plugin with NuGet, which we'll talk about a little later. But in my scripts directory, this is where all the code that I haven't written ends up. Actually get rid of that to make it a little cleaner. So I have Fancy Box, jQuery UI, Joyride, Smart Slider. And I'm just going to use the jQuery. I'm sorry, the Fancy Fancy Box real quick. So on my view, this means I'm going to go ahead and add it, because I may not have it on every page. I may just add it to a particular page. Of course, in 2012, I'll do the right thing and just drag it in, so I don't spell it wrong like I will do a bunch of times. Then bring it in with a relative path. I'm going to go ahead and use the new MVC4 trick of just using the tilde to say what the root directory is. And this will give me access to the FancyBox experience on the particular page, which means I can now, in my home index, do something with FancyBox. So on my page itself, I have an href which contains an image. And what I really want to do is turn this into using a way to pop up this image to see a larger version of it if I have it. You'll notice the href points to the same image in both cases, but ordinarily it would be a thumbnail here and a full version here. So all I need to do to use FancyBox is just to wire it up. I'm going to use jQuery to find my element. I can do that by saying I want to find the objects that are of class game boxes. I've defined this class as the things that show the game boxes, and that should be good enough. So I'm going to say dot game boxes. Let's make sure I got that right. Yeah. And this is going to return a collection of all the game boxes on the page. If there's one or there's 40 of them, it's still going to return a collection of them. And then I can just call fancy box right off of the page. Now there's some options we could put in here, but for the most part, FancyBox's extended jQuery by saying I'm adding another way to call a function off of a result, a set of results from jQuery. And then that way, that is the plugin model. So if we go out there and run this, and I click on the games gear, whoops, I forgot one more piece I should tell you about. And that is many of these, including FancyBox, also comes with their own content. So there's FancyBox's CSS. I will need to include that as well, so that the styling of a particular box, in this case, I'm borrowing from FancyBox, and they've included their own CSS for the design elements of that. Let's refresh again, and when I click it, we'll get this experience. It pops it up. If it were larger, includes a close button, grays out the rest of the screen, has some drop shadow, and allows me to do this. Now, as long as I've included both pieces of the plugin, the design elements in the CSS and the JavaScript, it ends up being a fairly quick way to extend my website to include this. You've probably seen this on 1,000 sites. Now that you see it, you go, oh, everyone must be using FancyBox, and you're right. Everyone is using FancyBox. So let's briefly talk about dependency management. In ASP.NET MVC, many of you may have run into NuGet, but if you haven't, I'm just going to briefly mention it. The power here is the ability to handle dependencies on the backend, on the server. And this is a good way that you can manage not only dependencies, but also versioning. So it helps keep them updated, and they're at the project level, so you can have different versions of a requirement on different websites. You don't have to upgrade everything to jQuery 1.7 if not every site needs to be updated to it. It's at the project level, not the machine level. And so if we look at our project over here, we could actually right-click it and look at, where did it go? Manage NuGet packages. And this will show me all the packages that I've installed in the project. And a number of these came with the project template. You can see that jQuery and jQuery UI are automatically included. There's some others for sort of the server-side core libraries, which I'm not going to dig into. But when we look at updates, it's going to tell us what parts of our project aren't in the newest versions. So jQuery is in the newest, but the JSON.NET has been updated, and we can see not only that it needs to be updated and what version it's going to be updated to, but if there were other dependencies, we could actually see what it relied on as well. And so the key here is, let's go back to installed packages. When we look at something jQuery UI, we can see that it has a dependency on a specific version of jQuery. So we can use jQuery UI, but jQuery UI can depend on a fairly old version of jQuery, the 1.4.4 version. And if we had installed just this dependency, it would have installed the oldest version required of that dependency. We could, of course, have upgraded it to 1.7.2, which is the newest version of jQuery itself. And we'll actually add a package here in a minute when we talk about our next topic. Now, as a developer, I hate CSS. At this point, usually in the talk, I ask people to raise their hand who love CSS and then berate them for loving CSS. It's usually one guy, and he's usually in the back. The reason I don't hate what CSS does for me, I hate the language itself because it doesn't give me the power that I'm used to as a developer. CSS is very declarative, so it's fairly easy to write once you understand sort of the semantics, but there's a lot of pieces that I'd love to be able to, not necessarily automate, but to have more control over. Because of this declarative nature, we tend to copy and paste CSS. Oh, I need this in another area, so I'll copy the color, I'll copy the font, I may even copy whole sections into this new rule in the CSS. And so it becomes harder to maintain over time. This duplication means that when I go to fix up a color or, let's say, a font face, I can forget about one, and especially one that's only used in a small number of cases, and suddenly everything looks great until someone gets to the About page, and then the footer looks awful, and you have to kind of trace that down. There are a number of languages that allow you to solve this, but Less is the one I'm going to detail here. Less is my preference here, and the Less isn't the most powerful of these dynamic style sheet languages. There's another one a lot of people like called Sass. But Less has enough of what I need in it, but is also the simplest for me to kind of deal with on a day-to-day basis, which is why I sit in the middle on this of I've never needed the extra power that something like Sass gives me. But having the ease of kind of development and deployment allows Less to do a lot of that work for me. The idea behind Less is simple. It compiles to CSS, and it introduces programming features into CSS, but most importantly, it looks and feels like CSS. And this is a point that shouldn't be lost. When you're working with Less, every line of valid CSS you have today is valid Less. Less isn't another language. It isn't based on Haml or something like that, like some of the other languages are trying. I can take a CSS file, name it Less, and it's a perfectly valid Less file. So that I can, as I mature my CSS files that maybe I get from a designer to using Less, it can be a maturation step, not this whole rewrite or whole restructuring. I can integrate the features of Less that I need only in the places I need them without having to rewrite entire files. .less is the NuGet package I use with MVC, with ASP.NET MVC. It also works, to the best of my knowledge, with ASP.NET web forms projects as well. And you simply add this as a NuGet package, and it adds the ability for Less files to be delivered to the browser, and let this Less packager, let this .less project do all the manipulation of converting the Less files into CSS files for you. So let's show how this works. I'm going to go ahead just to show you how NuGet works if you haven't worked with it before, and I'm just going to go online and search for .less. There's also a command line I could have used instead, but this shows it off a little better, so I'm going to start with that and just install .less, or .less. I really want to call it .less. Now that it's installed, this means that any file that I anytime that my project requests a .less file, it's going to process it through the less engine for me. So let's prove this. I have a little initialization CSS here. This is just some standard CSS that does some clearing stuff for me, and I'm going to go ahead and just rename this file to .less. Not even going to change a line of code, I'm just going to say init.less. When I do this and I go to content.slash init.less, I forgot to build it. Try that again. This is going to run it through the less processor and return to me the CSS that it delivered. So again, I don't have to include anything but renaming it to less for the less processor to work. So why the less processor? Why do I care about processing it as less? Let's take this site dot, dot less file and kind of explain it. Let's rename this to less as well. And this is just some standard CSS. I've got a footer and a header and a footer and some other elements here, some individual pieces, and I want to be able to rename them. And one of the interesting things, if we look at the way that the editors work here, is that the we have repeating elements here. We have a couple of colors we're reusing in a couple of places. We've got some font sizes we may be reusing, some font families. And as a developer, anytime I see a magic string like this, it makes me cringe a little inside. But if this were C sharp, I would immediately take this, make it a, some sort of constant value or some sort of factoried value, and then reuse it in all places. So later, if I had changed the background color, I can change them everywhere. And that's what less really allows us to do. So I can define variables, and I'll just call this back color. And then I can just replace it here. Now we're getting a little squigglies here because I don't have a less editor installed. There is one out there, I can't remember the name of it, that there's a free to try version that will integrate it here. But I'm used to not having using the editor anything more than a text editor anyway. So I've kind of, relegated myself to that. So if I come to here to site less, we can see we're getting the values. Well, maybe you think that, this is stuck from the old CSS file. So let's prove it by changing this color to green, right? So it's taking these values and pre-processing them for me in letting me do the sort of pieces I need with less. I'm able to change and have repeatable sections there. I could do the same with the padding values. I could do the same with colors with variables. That also let me do things like pretty sure that works. So I'm using functions to say compute the color green for me. And yeah, that didn't work. At Lightning. Yeah, I don't remember it. I shouldn't go off script. I should know better by now. But there are, you can look at the docs to really see the, allows you to manipulate colors. You can do addition as well. So let's say base font size is going to be 10 pixels, which I can certainly do here by copying this to my font size. So we can see the 10 pixel size for our font size, but I can also say times 1.5, right? I can use math to compute the value of 15 by multiplying it. So that later when we change that base font size, we can have it grow and change based on that. And so we're bringing in those design elements into our project in the way we really should. Allows these things to be much more maintainable. We can also import, and I'm going to import an init here. And notice I'm not giving an extension. CSS has the notion of import, and what import does is make the browser make a second request to import that item for us. What import here does, if we're dealing with less files, not with CSS, but with less files, it will import right where the import is, whatever that second file is. And so we can keep a bunch of our design elements separate, but then bring them all together at the end as one large file, which means that we can handle the composition of these files in a much simpler way, but still have the benefit of maintaining them as domain-specific pieces. We'll see that it also, we won't see it actually, but this also supports the things like caching and minimizing these as well. There are settings in the web.config that you can include. Getting a little late on time, so I'm going to move ahead with the next piece, which is debugging. So traditionally, as a Visual Studio and Visual C++ before that developer, or even a VB, 5 and 6 developer at one time, I'm used to using the IDEs to develop. But the reality is that debugging now is a lot richer because we can use the browsers themselves to debug. Now, all four browsers, and I'm really including IE, Firefox, Safari, and Chrome, not necessarily in that order. I am not talking, they all support debuggers. IE has its own. It's one that used to be the developer toolbar, and it's okay. The WebKit has developer tools that Safari and Chrome both use, and they're very good. And Firefox recently has included the WebKit debugging tools, but I tend to use Firefox with a different set of tools. There's two tools, the Web Developer Bar and Firebug, and I tend to use them for a couple of reasons. One is the clean browser principle. And so for me, Firefox isn't a browser I use on my machine on a daily basis. I don't use it to browse the web. And so Firefox ends up being my developer browser. It doesn't have my favorites in there. I haven't installed FlashBlock and forgot about it. I haven't done anything like that. It's a nice clean environment for doing day-to-day development. And I also think that Firebug are the most mature of the tools. Firebug, I think, is more intuitive and more natural than the WebKit tools, but not by much. They're pretty close. The interesting part is that you are going to end up having to use all four tools at some point someday. You're going to have some peculiarity in Chrome or in IE, and you'll have to go to their tools, and their tools are pretty similar to what Firebug gives you anyway. So you aren't really going to, hurt yourself by using Firebug. You're going to find that they're going to be pretty similar. And you may decide that you want to use Chrome with the WebKit tools. You may decide you want to use IE with its tools. It doesn't matter. The important part is you're going to be doing a lot more debugging in the browser. And an important idea here is that you're not just debugging code. You're debugging design and structure as well. Again, those three sort of tenets here, code plus design plus markup equals web page. And you're going to be able to debug all three. And so let's take a look at how we would do this. So if we go back to our original page, we've got just somebody renamed a file. I didn't show you, but since it came up, I will show you it. Is in my layout, I have the CSS for my site, the site.css, but we renamed it to less. So I just have to rename the URL here to less. And I should do the same with init since I renamed them both. Actually, I included in it, so I don't need to do that anymore. And then if I didn't go off script too much, there we have it. Now notice that green we had put in the less file is now showing up, but that shouldn't matter. So here we have that very simple website, and the tools are twofold. One is this web developer toolbar here up here, which gives us some ability to kind of look at the structure. The only things that are really interesting here for me is being able to do things like disable cache, so that I don't have to deal with web cache while I'm doing development. Sometimes that ends up biting me. And also resize when I'm doing mobile development, so I can resize the window. If you were at my earlier talk, you saw how I did those. I'm going to focus on the actual web Firebug tools. These Firebug tools are installed here in the browser, and will show you a number if there are actual bugs on the page. So before we introduce some bugs, let's go ahead and just click it, and it'll show up either as a separate window or on the bottom. You can actually move and change its location. If you change this to minimize it, it gets rid of it, or clicking back, and we can go ahead and pop it up as its own window and decide to dock it really anywhere we want. I'm going to leave it docked to the bottom of the page because that's where I'm used to it, and I'm only on one monitor, so it ends up working out pretty well. First piece, if you haven't seen this before, is this little element. This is going to allow me to actually look around the page, and it's showing me this highlight of what I'm over, and then syncing it to what's in the content window under HTML. So if I want to look at what is in this whole div I'm dealing with, it takes me to that div and then allows me to go ahead and open that up and dive into the individual pieces. This is where I can really look at the structure, and an important thing about this structure as you look at it is this is the interpreted HTML. This isn't the source of the HTML. The reason I say that is that this may be different than the HTML you delivered from the browser. Now, the reason that is if you're is browsers are meant to be tolerant of bad HTML. So if you're missing an end tag, or you did div with a closing end quote, ending angle bracket, this is going to try to interpret that the best way it can. It may not do a very good job of it, interpreting your intent, but this will be what the browser is actually displaying. So understand that this is really the live DOM. This isn't the file that was sent down to the browser. Usually they're going to be pretty much the same, but being aware of that can really help you. When we look at these elements, I can actually go ahead and just edit them. So if I click on here and let's add a new class in here of float left. This is going to change the classes that are applied there in a live way. And if I had a class that it mattered to, it would have done that. Or I can even add ad hoc styling, which you should never actually put in your markup. But if I wanted to say height 500, it's going to make that change immediately as I type to make sure that the height of that element is 500. And so in this way, we can look at and manipulate the structure. As we're looking at different elements, we can also use this pane on the right-hand side, which is going to show us what has been applied in CSS. And this is going to directly infer the CSS rules. So game info has these elements. But if I looked at something like I'm going to try to find one that had an override, but I don't have one. So I look at this button, and as I scroll down, we're going to see other rules, and we're going to see that they're crossed out. And the reason they're crossed out is that a later rule, a cascaded rule, a rule that overrode this behavior, is in the list. So we can see, oh, we got font size from this part of the CSS, but some later rule, the one that was further up on the list, specified font size 100% to override what I had put as the font size. And so you can really learn sort of the nature of cascades here. You can also, when looking at, and let's go back to our div here, We can look at the different elements that are in our rule, and I tend to do a lot of my CSS work here because I can go ahead and say, which one of these is making it look weird? Oh, I can disable the background, or I can see it go away, I can get rid of the border, and so I can start to get a sense of what parts of the rule are doing what. These are pretty simple styles, but I can actually even add my own styles here, so or my own elements of the rule. So if I said border radius 10 pixels, we can see that we now have rounded corners on that. So there's an interesting piece here, though, is that when I have an item selected here, I could go ahead and type 10 pixels again, or 11 pixels, or I can use the arrow keys to just move up and down to tweak these elements of it. And I spend a lot of time debugging the design in this way. In fact, let's do one more that will show you kind of the power of this display. Now, I may not know what all the valid values of display, because display is an enumerated value. It's not just a number or something. And by going up and down, it's going to go through the enumerated values and show me what's happening with those display. Like if I go down and look at, you know, inline block versus block, what is that like? Run in, absolute, whatever the case may be. I can really decide what the I can really learn about CSS by using these debugger features of the designer. Script works in much the same way, in that the script tag tab here is going to show me what scripts are in here. And here I'm using jQuery, but by popping it down, I can see all the scripts that are loaded on that particular page. So if I click on my home index, I can actually see the code that was running here in for my particular page. I can set breakpoints as you would in Visual Studio to get it to break. Let's go ahead and click load games. Well, I might not know that there's any code there. Let's try it there. No, it's because I have an empty method there. Well, let's do it this way instead. Set a breakpoint there and let's refresh the page. And we can see that it stopped here, like it would, because it's actually executing this on initialization of the page. We can tell what the arguments are to the method. We can see what the window is. We can create our own watch point. So if we wanted to even type in some arbitrary code here, like a jQuery expression, it'll go in here and allow us to look through it and see what the different parts are. So it gives us a pretty rich experience for dealing with debugging of our particular page. You can walk through, walk in, and walk out, all the things you're used to in Visual Studio with C# code. If you right-click instead of left-click to create a debug point, you can actually write an expression here. So if I say something like game boxes length is greater than 0, this will create a computed breakpoint, so that only when that query comes back as true, which in this case there's more than one game box, it will stop there. If we were missing a game box on this page, that breakpoint would never have been stopped on. And there's a lot more here, taking a look at, you know, the structure of the DOM, and even looking at the networking code. Yeah, let's talk about the networking really briefly. Another piece of the debugging that I hadn't mentioned earlier, but we should, and that is networking. And this will tell you what is happening on the page. When we go and run a particular page, what is being loaded, let's go to all, to run this particular page? We're first getting the original page, and then it gets the style, jQuery, less file, etc. We can see all the elements, even the image requests that were made by the page, and we can get a sense of the timing of our page. How long is it taking? We can even, when we hover over, get a sense of, is it waiting for an available request socket to be open? Like in this case, it's in a blocking state for 6 milliseconds because these other things are already making requests, as many requests as the browser can. So it gets left in a wait state until it gets its turn to make a request. And so you can really look at this in a rich way to determine how well your page loading is performing. And if you had, API calls in JavaScript, those would show up here as well. We can look at each of these requests, and we can see what the headers were for them, what was actually returned in this case. This is all that CSS, and even information about whether it's cached. It may be a little hard to see here, but let me see if I can zoom in for you. We can see that we're getting the status of these requests as well. And all these not modifieds are there saying none of these other files have been modified, so I'm not going to download them. In essence, grab these from the cache because you're dealing with the latest versions of them. And so you can get quite a lot of information about your request. You can categorize them in the different sort of elements, CSS, JavaScript. Any API requests would go through XHR, images, etc. So you can really get a good sense of what is going on with the page and do some debugging of that experience as well. So we're not simply talking about debugging in the of JavaScript and code. We're talking about debugging the entire web experience. And everything I've shown you here so far with Firebug is pretty much the same in all the browsers. There's a bunch of other tools in here that I haven't covered that if you want some more in-depth, I do have a Pluralsight course on, but just investigating these tools and spending some time with them, you'll find that it's going to be a lot easier than the old tried and true trying to get Visual Studio debugging to work in a meaningful way. Clicking here in Visual Studio, I have to launch, attach, refresh the page if I'm not using IE, and then I can get this to be stopped. That isn't, to me, a very good experience. So, packaging. We talked about a minute ago the networking and how we're getting a bunch of different requests at once. We often will want to take a look at this and really look at and package up a bunch of these requests all together so that we're making fewer larger requests. And that's where packaging comes in. It's about reducing the size and the number of these downloads. It's letting the browser cache do its job so that it's trying to be cache sensitive to downloading the things that may not be cached. When you're dealing with shared libraries like jQuery or jQuery UI, you'll probably want to get those from the browser's cache instead of having them download from your server for a number of reasons. But, two of them would be that to make sure that to reduce the load on your server and the speed to develop that the user is using the page. But also so you don't have to deal with sort of the versioning problem yourself. And in many ways, you can think of this as the JS compilation step. So when you package your own JavaScript, you can take the pretty sort of JavaScript and make a minimized version that may will be used just by the browser. And in a lot of ways, this is canonically the same as compiling C# to IL. Compiling JavaScript to minimize JavaScript is a lot like IL. In fact, they're both jitted from that intermediate form, so it's about the same idea. You can use packaging to do it for less as for CSS or less as well. I tend to use less to do most of my CSS packaging, so I can do it in a pretty straightforward way. So there's a few ways to do this. The MVC4 packaging works, and it's still maturing, in my opinion. It's kind of going through a couple of phases right now where it's getting more and more features that we need. I tend to not use it because I've been using another packager that already does everything I want, so you may find it doesn't meet all your needs, but I think in the long term it probably will be the one and best packager. Squishit is the one I use. This is a very mature packager. It allows me at a programmatic level to really decide what is being packaged and how, and supports things like failover as well as CDN packaging, which I'll show you in a minute. Chirpy's another one. It's not at the project level. It's at the machine level or Visual Studio level. It's an add-in that allows your files to be converted into CSS as you write your LESS or your SAS files. And then Cassette is one that works with Visual Studio. It's very powerful, but I find it a bit too complex to set up. But if you have very complex requirements, Gossette is probably the most powerful one out there. Squishit, which I'm going to focus on because I find it sort of that, again, that middle ground between functionality and ease of use, allows me to do directory-based grouping, so I can say just package everything in a particular directory. Allows me to deal with remote and local fallback, and then supports both JavaScript CSS as well as some other pieces. The way I use this is I have, typically in a project, I'll have a helper. Let me go ahead and uncomment this out so you can see what this looks like. That just uses Squishit to say, I want to make a bundle. I think I haven't commented out up here yet. I'm using the Squishit framework and then a minimizer for JavaScript. Now notice that Squishit isn't coming in, and that's because I need the NuGet package. So let's go ahead and add NuGet. You can see that it's since it's already in there, I use it enough. And Squishit has a number of dependencies. Dotlist it uses for the creation, as well as Ajax, Min, Jurassic, and the other compressor in order to compress, allow you to have some choice about how you're compressing your objects. And once I have Squishit, I'm just telling it to create a bundle for JavaScript, and I'm adding particular scripts in. This particular method I'm building here is just going to render the scripts folder for me, so I can choose what scripts are included. So in this case, I'm just going to include jQuery non-minimized version because I'm in debug, but in release mode. And this is one of the features I really like out of Squishit, is it's going to allow me to do something called add remote. So I can pull jQuery from the Google CDN, which would be the, you know, the most cached version of this. And if for some reason this goes down, it includes a local version of it so that if this one fails, this one will succeed. So I can get the benefits of sort of both worlds. I don't have the single point of failure, but I'm also using the best cache by using CDNs. And then I'm including the other pieces of my package here. And then I'm just telling it to go ahead and render it out onto the page with a name if it needs a name. Now in this case, I'm actually just this packager for my scripts aren't going to actually package them because I want them to pull the pieces that aren't important to the project, that aren't important to cache. I want them to pull them from their original sources, and then the rest will just be listed on the page. So to use this, I'll go over to my layout. And I'm doing this at the layout level because these are scripts that are going to happen in every case. So I'm just going to comment out my scripts. And here, I'm just going to say at html.renderScripts. And here, it will just spit out those scripts for me that I have set up in my helper. It's going to include all of these scripts that I happen to need. So we go back and look at the page. We can see we now have all those scripts. And if we look at the raw HTML, we can see that these were each injected on their own line. So let's take these scripts and let's see what happens when we go to release. Let me recompile it since we're in release mode. And in release mode, we get something a little different. We can see we now have the Ajax Google API CDN request to jQuery. And then we also have included in this package script, we can see modern dev scripts and then a magic number. This is the rest of the scripts that I needed packaged up together in one file. Because they're all coming from my server, I'm reducing the number of script requests into one single script request. And that number is enabling me to make sure that this is going to be cached for the life of this build. This number is not going to change as the build changes, so that we're getting the same version of that cached file over and over again. To go back to debug, and let's talk about the second one. And this one's a lot simpler in that I'm going to render all of my scripts. And all I'm going to do is say, create a bundle, add everything in my JS folder. And this is one of the reasons I like to keep my scripts in a separate folder than the scripts folders. I'm just going to say, as I add scripts, include them on the page. So I don't have to go and re-add those scripts every time I need one on a particular page. And if we go back to the site layout and do the same thing here with libs, or render.js, I should say. That means that here on my home page, whoops, I don't need either of these. Because the fancy box is being included by scripts, and this home index is being included because it happens to be in my home dot, my home, my JS directory. So now we can see it's automatically just pulling in all these scripts for me, and as the maturation of my project goes forward, as I add new scripts into the JS folder, they're just going to appear here. So I can drop a new script for a new page, and it will just appear, and then later on, I'll package up all of these when I'm doing it in release mode, and everything in JS will just be in one large JavaScript file. You can do something more eloquent by doing it in sort of a module basis for a very large site, but this gives you the power to really do, you know, whichever path you want to take. So a couple of takeaways, and then we'll get to some questions. So if you have any questions, go ahead and put them in the Q&A while I talk about this last slide. These slides and this demo will be up on wildermuth.com probably by tomorrow morning. So if you want to go get them, you can get this entire project just as I've worked with it, so you can kind of play with it in action. Some important links, MVC4 and ASP.NET, jQuery, GitHub, where a lot of the jQuery plugins are going to be, lesscss.org is where you'll see the entire less syntax, so as you want to learn that. And then the Squishit, there's a short link over to the Squishit website. And then finally, my company. So let's take a look, see if there's any questions before we break. So Trevor Fawcett asks, does .list and less files, can they be used with MVC4 bundling? I already split my CSS into forms, list, common. Could I lessify them too before bundling them into a single CSS for deployment? That would be great. Couple of different methods for doing this. Either you could use the built-in MVC4 stuff, which I believe does support less as of the last drop, or you could just use .less and include a master one that included all the scripts. You could also use something like Squishit to include them all at once, just to include them at the top, sort of like I'm doing with JS. I tend to do that less, no pun intended, I tend to do that less of the time and just let less do the packaging for me. But you could certainly use Squishit and I believe the MVC4 packaging, though I'm sure someone will correct me, to do that as well. Dylan has a question that he believes he sometimes sees styles applied by the WebKit that seem to be overcoding my hand styles. Is that the purpose of CSS reset essentially, or am I off my rocker? Well, he's sort of implying something that I hinted at in the project here, and that is I'm using a CSS file called init that actually comes from Eric Meyer on Meyer Web. And this, when you start off with the browsers, with the WebKit browsers especially, there are some default properties for most of your elements. This init.css file, which I earlier renamed to a .less file, resets most of these to what we would expect them to be. It also does some fixes up for non-HTML5 compliant browsers, so that it deals with making sure that everything that is in the HTML5 controls, that are all, they're all displayed as block, and we can see that this first reset is pretty important in that it gets rid of outlines, padding, border, font size, all of that for those elements. And so I typically use an init CSS on all my pages to kind of start this. Again, Eric Meyer Webb, MeyerWebb.com has this reset in there, and that's where I get it and probably where you should get it. I believe this is also included in the HTML5 boilerplate.org, I think it is, which is where I got this particular page design. This isn't directly from the MVC4 page design. See if there's any more questions. Can I use Squishit with web forms? I haven't done it, but my understanding is yes. You would need to, on your page, call out to the to spit out the string. You wouldn't do it in a HTML helper like I did with MVC. You would do it with probably a static class that you could then call on your particular page, like on your master page. And Snip, I don't think I want to say that incorrectly, but there's a question, can I pre-process compile less? Doesn't have to be processed on every request. Let me answer that in two pieces. First, can you pre-process or compile less? You can. Some of the other tooling that I mentioned in the packaging support pre-compilation of it. The way that less .less works is it compiles it on the first request and then caches it. So once you deploy it to your website, it will go ahead and cache it. There's pluses and minuses to that. I like it in that as I'm doing development, I don't have to recompile the app or make the change and make sure that it's not dealing with cached versions of it in my page. So my development experience is pretty free there. The other piece about it is doesn't have to some of the other packagers, Chirpy is one of them that will pre-process it, and then it would just grab CSS files then that less were compiled into. Depends on what it's more of a development pattern than it is a right or wrong. If you're more comfortable with having them compiled first and then delivering them as CSS, I don't have any problem with that. It's just the style that I've decided it works best for me in my development environment. And the last question is, will the recording be available? Yes, we're recording this. It'll be up as and be able to be streamed. I don't know how long it will take ASP.conf to get them all up there onto the website, but hopefully it'll be soon. Thanks, everyone, for coming by. It's been a great session. If you need me, again, you can reach me at wildermuth.com, and you'll be able to get the source code and the slides there. Have a great day, everyone, and enjoy the conference.